Whose station?
Our station.
Whose control?
Our control.
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
And the previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane on WBAI 99.5 FM. This week, we are joined by two wonderful rebels from New England. Maria Ogden from Vermont is a proud grandmother. And for some years now, a member, active member of Extinction Rebellion based in Vermont. And we're going to hear from her about the action she's been involved in recently. And in the Maria, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Matt. It's great to be here.
And we are joined by Sue Durling from XR New Hampshire. Sue has also been involved in actions recently, some of them the same ones as Maria, some of them different. We're interested and excited to hear from Sue about what she's been up to and what she thinks other people can do to help the movement. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Matt. It's good to be here.
So what is the most recent action in Massachusetts that you each participated in? Maybe I'll ask Sue first and Maria second. What have you been participating in recently in Massachusetts along with some other rebels?
I believe we were both at the Flood the Seaport action, right, Maria?
That's correct.
What was the Flood the Seaport action?
So Flood the Seaport was an action that was meant to bring awareness to the fact that so much public money has been spent on this neighborhood in Boston that's being developed as the sea levels rise. This is a neighborhood that's going to be underwater in probably a decade, and yet billions of public dollars have been spent there. And there is housing in that neighborhood, but it's like the most expensive housing in all of Boston. So it's a very skewed use of public resources. And so the concept behind the action was to bring awareness to that and to also sort of encourage people to understand that Extinction Rebellion has a playful, joyous side and that we know how to throw a good party. So we did a couple of we tried to do a couple of banner drops off of hotel roofs. And then we also had a fabulous parade that went through the seaport. We had a band and dancing and lots of good costumes and art.
How did it feel to participate in that event?
Oh, man, it was a lot of fun. We had a marching band and there was the Winds of Change Brigade with banners and flyers that flapped in the wind. It was just a beautiful sight. And all the rebels there singing and chanting. It was a Friday evening, wasn't it? And there was a lot of people out watching us. It was pretty cool.
I heard one rebel describe the Seaport District in Boston as this giant beacon of climate denialism for exactly the reasons that Maria just described. It is projected to be underwater and they are building right there on the coast. And it's a low, low lying area.
Yeah, it already floods at extreme at king tides now.
Yeah.
So to stick with Massachusetts actions for a moment, who is Charlie Baker and why, Sue, were you part of a protest against him?
Charlie Baker is the governor of Massachusetts, and he makes himself out to be a climate hero, but he's really a climate zero. He's approved a lot of infrastructure projects that shouldn't have been approved, and we'd like him to pay a little more attention, especially to indigenous and BIPOC communities, which he seems to be landing these projects in.
Mm-hmm. One of those projects is not the only one, but one of them is the Weymouth Compressor Station. We've done an episode on Weymouth Compressor Station maybe about a month ago, maybe more like 6 weeks ago. So what all took place in this action?
A giant 27-foot pink sailboat with the words climate emergency was parked at the end of his driveway at 7 o'clock one weekday morning.
With and several.
Good morning.
Good morning, Governor Baker. And all the state police officers that sit outside his house. And some rebels jumped out and locked on.
Now, we would like all listeners to be clear on something. Was there any chance whatsoever of Governor Baker or any of his family getting physically hurt from this action?
Absolutely not. We were careful to not even step on their grass. We didn't want to get charged with trespassing. And we were very, very aware of safety. We made sure that the state police were notified right away before, just as we pulled up, that we were nonviolent, that we had no weapons, and we were not intending any violence.
Okay. Now, what exactly did you do? There's no need to reveal any of the special details that make our tactics work, but just help the audience envision some of the specifics of what went down.
Well, I was basically watching and recording. The rebels locked on. I took a few pictures, and by then the police, they were right there. So they ordered me away from the boat, and I began doing a live broadcast. At that point, they started telling the rebels that they were going to move the boat without detaching them, without extracting them. And I became very worried that if they carried that out, they would break arms or, you know, seriously hurt somebody. And I told them so. Mm-hmm. And I began a live feed, and it turned out it was just an empty threat. After so, that, the name, go ahead.
Well, it may have, who knows exactly what was in the police's mindset, but it may have been trying to get the people to detach. And
yeah,
if I understand you right, Sue, nobody actually detached. They held their space. Is that correct?
They did hold their space. They had to call, apparently Massachusetts contracts out extraction. So they had to have private contractors come and cut them out.
How long were they attached?
I think it was about 2 hours.
Okay.
Time flies when you're having fun.
So you say there are actually people who specialize in detaching. Is that what you're telling us?
Apparently so. when we were in New York, the police did a very good job of doing it on their own. And I must say, much more professional job than the people in Massachusetts did.
Oh. Sue, do you know how many people were arrested as part of this action and how long they stayed in custody?
I believe it was seven. And they were in custody, let's see, they were arrested about 9 and got out about 4 or 5 o'clock. So
okay.
About 7 or 8 hours.
Okay. So each of you has been part of protesting something called the Bow Plant. This is something in New Hampshire. Would you tell us what the Bow Plant is and what these protests are all about?
It's Merrimack Power Station. It is the last coal plant in New England that doesn't have a closing date. And it is used as a peaker plant, which is a stupid way to use coal if you're even going to use it.
What does it peaker plant do? What is it? Can you explain that for listeners?
A peaker plant fires up when you need more energy quickly. A perfect peaker plant would be something like a dam that you could just open a spillway and get instant kilowatt. But a coal plant takes about 3 days to come up to speed, to come up to heat, to be at an efficiency level. Meanwhile, it's spewing dirty coal emissions.
So, Maria, what is the scene at these protests at the Bow plant? What takes place?
Well, the one that I was present for was it had two elements. One element was the more public gathering, and it was a rally with speakers and music and costumes and banners, and it was very festive. It was totally legal. They had a permit for it, and it was about maybe a quarter mile away from the plant's entrance. That particular day was really bizarre because this whole action, the rally had been advertised for a while by No Coal, No Gas. So it was public information. And the local and state and even federal response was extraordinary. There were there were police or, police officers from every imaginable police force, including the railroad police, which was a force I was not aware of before this. There were people on the river, police officers and the law was out that they had a helicopter buzzing us. They had drones. It was crazy. I mean, there really were literally people in riot gear for a bunch of us with flags and, you know, chants and songs and speakers. So it was an interesting experience, but it was also, I think, a very powerful one for so many of us, even if we weren't involved in the arrestable action itself. It was one of my first big actions, to be honest, and I really found myself engaged in the community nature of these kinds of, especially larger actions like this, where we actually went the night before. We stayed at a church. 100 of us were there, and you know, we had to eat, we had to meet, we had to figure out roles, we had to, and we all slept there. It was a really good experience for me. And then after the fact, after all of our the 60 or so people had been arrested, there a bunch of us waited around, and then we were part of the support team to welcome them back. And that also was a really powerful experience, feeding them, making sure they were, their needs were met, and that everybody got home safe.
I was at the same protest as Maria in 2019, and I was also in a less risky role. I was protesting at the front gate, trying to create a diversion for the people who are sneaking around back. A good friend of mine got arrested, but it was, as Maria described, a big party that was very heavily watched by the authorities.
You know, I'm curious, what would you say the ratio of state power to the people was in terms of numbers?
Oh gosh.
It felt like 1-to-1. I mean, at least for the, well, let me say this, for the people who were actually being arrested, it was easily 4 law enforcement officers to every 1 person. Would you say that's accurate, Sue? Does that seem
accurate? I would. And I certainly would say they had us out machined.
Oh my gosh.
The helicopters and the drones and the big riot vehicles and
SUVs, bulletproof SUVs. I mean, it was such an over-the-top response.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio. We are Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney, and the station is WBAI 99.5 FM New York. We are speaking with Maria Ogden and Sue Durling about recent Extinction Rebellion actions in New York, New Hampshire, and Boston. So you were talking about the police state versus protester ratio. How did it feel being out there with such an awesome force? How did it feel doing that protest, knowing that you were facing that awesome force?
I felt like the truth must be dangerous.
And so it is. And so it is.
Yeah. I was very grateful for the solidarity of all of the other people who were there. It helped me feel more supported. It has in every single situation once the police forces start to show up, when the law starts to show up. And, you know, having now been in actions in rural areas and urban areas, not a whole bunch of them, but kind of 2 and 2 at this point, 2 in the country and 2 in the city. I have been honestly felt more concerned when I've been in rural settings than in urban settings. And I say that as a cis white woman. So I recognize that my experience is quite different than many people's experience, but, that's been my experience so far.
Yeah, I agree. We do have privilege. But yeah, I did feel that the police in the city were more used to handling protesters, and the police in the country were very worried about what we might do.
Shall we talk about the New York bank blocking actions that each of you was present at? Would you tell us what took place? And then after you do that, would you tell us what your personal experience of those actions was?
Sue, you want to lead in?
Oh, sure. We had a sailboat, another sailboat, not the pink one, that was christened Necessary Trouble. And we took the intersection with it and shut down Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, for the day. It was fabulous. There were so many rebels that were doing so many coordinated things. It was things I didn't even know about till I got there and was locked on and then was watching. Maria, I'll let you go ahead and tell a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah, that's just to piggyback on that. The action was part of a larger action that was taking place in New York City, targeting the banks, the three biggest banks that are fossil fuel funders, in that in particular, we have concerns about because they're funding Line 3, which is a tar sands pipeline going through a lot of indigenous land in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so these, as Sue said, this was one part of four actions of that day. We were able to block off the entryway to JP Morgan Chase, their international office, for until like from 8 in the morning till what, about 1:30 in the afternoon. And one of the most interesting things about the action was that it wasn't really focused so much on interacting with the public in New York, because it's a small street and there, and the police had walled us off very quickly. But what it was really effective in terms, we felt like our target audience what ended up being a whole crew of construction workers that were in a nearby, they were building a nearby sky rise, high rise. The employees of JP Morgan Chase, who were actually kept quarantined in the building by their security forces. So we felt like we saw tons of people looking out the windows from JP Morgan Chase. So we felt like we actually got some opportunity to get our message out to those folks to say, hey, you know, you have a voice as an employee of this big company, you should squawk a little bit. And then ultimately, we really talked a lot to the police. They probably 45 or 50 police officers showed up. Does that sound right, Sue?
It does.
And they were standing there for quite a while. And we were grateful for the opportunity to be able to speak to them directly about the fact that climate change is impacting their city. I mean, Hurricane Ida had just come through New York City less than 2 weeks before that. 40 people in New York City died because of Hurricane Ida and in flooding. And it was interesting. I think we had those three audiences, and they were really felt like good audiences.
They were really ready to hear the message.
Did you find that the police were ready to hear the message when you were at the coal plant? I'm wondering about the difference and whether or not you've had conversations.
Well,
the same kind of conversation.
Yeah, different police force and different law enforcement, right? We're talking mm-hmm. about sheriffs and state troopers and all of that versus the New York City. What is there? They have a special squad of police officers who are dedicated. They're actually part of the Homeland Security team, and their role is either to work against, you know, terrorist attacks or or protesters. So they are trained in dealing with large crowds of people. But yeah, definitely had a very different vibe than I've had in other settings, for sure.
I felt like in Bo that they might be sympathetic, but they might not want to admit it in front of the other police forces that were there, because there was, you know, the stateies and the local police and everybody else.
So we haven't actually managed to get to the getting arrested part yet. Sue, would you tell us your experience exactly? What happened to you in New York?
Sure. First, I want to say that the getting arrested part is not the goal. The goal is to get the message out, and getting arrested just makes people pay attention.
Agreed. Thanks, Sue.
Yeah. So I was locked onto the trailer, so I was one of the first ones to be extricated, and I couldn't see much during the extrication because they put a blanket over my head while the sparks flew. But I wasn't afraid because my dad was a mechanic, and he would always say, hold this and close your eyes. So I've been used to that. So once they got me free, I was arrested, zipped tied, handcuffed, and put in the prisoner transport vehicle, I guess it's called. From there, I was able to watch a few more people get extracted from the boat and be brought into me. And I was able to see our other friends that were probably close to two blocks away, waving a little flag far, far away. And I knew they were down there, still being there for us, and that felt really good. I was in custody about 5.5 hours. And when I came out, there were my friends waiting and cheering for me, and it felt really good to be out. And I, even though I knew intellectually they would be there, I was still surprised. It was great.
So this is Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney hosting Extinction Rebellion Radio on 99.5 FM New York, WBAI. We are talking about a protest in New York and another one in Boston and another one in New Hampshire with two folks who were smack in the middle of them, Sue Durling and Maria Ogden. Now, if you don't mind my bringing personal life into this just a little bit, a lot of times when people picture environmental protesters who do things like lock themselves to boats and get arrested, they might picture, a 20-year-old ratty-haired person, perhaps with torn clothing and unkept, who smokes certain substances some of the time and talks in a certain way. And this might be the image, you know, the sort of hippie image of this type of person. Now, you are both, neither of you fit that description. You are both grandmothers from New England. Could you tell us, how did you come to climate activism? Each of you has been arrested multiple times at climate protests, Sue, I believe, twice, Maria, four times. It's interesting, this situation. Please tell us would you tell us how you came to climate activism and just sort of comment on these stereotypes of climate activists, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, Maria. I've been talking for a while.
Okay, thanks, Sue. I came to this place because what triggered the whole thing, two things triggered it. One was I had my first grandchild about 4 years ago, and I'd been very interested in social justice, and my husband was more interested in climate change and all of the emergency around that. But he hadn't found a way to plug in, nor had I. The birth of our grandson was a real inflection moment for us both. I think especially for me, realizing how I'm accountable to him. And now I am to two other grandchildren. So I have three grandchildren now. The other thing that was really powerful for me was I saw Greta Thunberg's, one of her first speeches, and it was quite powerful. You know, I felt like she was really speaking directly to me to say, get up off your couch and do something. So I have, you know, been involved with Extinction Rebellion for about 3 years, and I just decided to start from scratch. I don't have experience in activism particularly. I'm an organizer of other types, but not of this sort of thing. So it was for me a matter of just opening my eyes, to be perfectly honest, because there are opportunities everywhere for nonviolent direct action training, for learning how to fill different roles in terms of street action. And once I got started in that, you know, in that kind of flow, it was really easy to just move successively. So I started with street medic training because that's a natural thing for me. I've been to a number of different protests, actions, rallies as a street medic. That gave me some familiarity. And then having observed a couple of actions in New York City in the spring of 2019, I was just like, wow, this is a good way to feel like I'm doing something and get to know people who I will feel connection with as we do it. And it's just become the most logical way for me to cope with the chaotic world that we're living in, that we have been living in, whether we're talking about the climate emergency or whether we're talking about racial injustice or whether we're talking about the pandemic. All of it has felt easier for me personally because of activism. And I will say that originally this was about my three grandchildren for me. And that's, it just blossomed because now I realize it's about everything. It's about every living being. You know, it's about all of the species that are going extinct. It's about our water. It's about our air. It's about our poor ocean. So it's been an incredible growing experience for me.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio. Hi, I'm John Tarleton, host of the Independent News Hour. Americans head to the polls Tuesday for the first general election since Donald Trump's defeat last November. New York voters will choose their next mayor and city council. Join the Independent for an election night special Tuesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. We'll follow key races in New York and beyond, and we'll look at deeper trends driving local and national politics. We'll speak with special guests like WBAI's Tom Robbins and Ben Max, Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing, and Linda Martine Alkoff, author of The Future of Whiteness. Join us Tuesday night, 7 to 9 p.m. here on WBAI, an election night special.
David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
This is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.